Thank you for that beautiful message and song. Good morning and happy Sabbath. Our message for today is Shadows of Greatness, Failure, Triumph, and Faith. I'd like to begin with a reading from the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 2, and verse 9. First Samuel chapter 2, verse 9. He will keep the feet of his saints, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For by strength shall no man prevail. I have chosen this morning to share with you the story of three lives. The lives of Samson, Saul, and Paul. The first two just looked like rising stars, big, brawny, handsome. The third, we're not sure. Maybe he was good-looking. Perhaps, as one of his disciples suggested, he was a bit on the mousy side. But all three undoubtedly entered the world on tracks that seemed headed straight for the stars. All would share violent deaths, but of the three, only one could look through that experience, could look through the final storm we'll all face at some point, and see a crown. Story number one, the first life that we will discuss today, is the story of Samson. A miracle child. Have you noticed how a lot of the miracle babies are to be found throughout the Bible? Isaac, Samuel, John the Baptist, Jesus himself, and yes, dear tragic Samson. So Samson was a miracle. He shouldn't have even been born and wouldn't have, but for God's gift to a childless couple. Let's open the Word, Judges chapter 13, verses 2 and 3. Judges 13, verse 2. And there was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren and bore not. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, Behold now, thou art barren and bearest not, but you will conceive and bear a son. Now get the picture. Put this in some historical context. For 40 long, miserable years, Israel has been under the boot of the Philistines. Crops stolen, animals taken, slaves taken, villages, cities destroyed. A people in slavery for 40 dreadful years, actually longer than the nation had wandered in the wilderness. It was time for a new generation, a generation of young people, to come in to change the status quo and to deliver the country from the mess it had sunken into. It's pretty much what happened with the pioneers of the Adventist message. Most of them young people, most of them under 20 years of old, came together at a magic moment in history to bring us the Adventist message. So heaven has a dream. A dream that Israel can overcome its captivity. A dream that would be carried by a powerful young man, born into a godly home with every spiritual advantage, even prenatally. Pick up with verse 4. Now therefore beware, I pray you, and drink not wine nor strong drink, and eat not any unclean thing. Before the child is even to be born, the angel of the Lord gives Manoah and his wife prenatal instructions for the care and raising of this special child. Why is that? I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with today's prenatal research that has shown third trimester babies in utero reacting to the outside world. When their parents argue, they move closer and listen. When there's music, they react to it. They are aware of the outside world, they know what's going on, and it shapes who they will become as an adult. Of course, heaven knew this long before we did. And so an angel comes to Samson's parents and says, be very, very careful how you raise this child. Even from before he is born, he's paying attention. He knows what's happening. He is affected by the choices that you will make. So verse 8. After the soon-to-be mother of Samson runs home and tells Manoah this news as to how the child is to be raised, Manoah himself prays for direction as to how to raise his son. Verse 8, Manoah entreats the Lord and says, O my Lord, let the man of God which you did send come again to us and teach us what we will do to the child that you are giving us, to the child that will be born. So not only has the mother received prenatal care instructions, now Manoah himself prays to God in a touching act of innocence, asking for how to raise his son. How do I do it right, dear God? How do I raise this child in the way you would have him to go? And so two humble peasants, through a simple prayer, find themselves en route to a meeting with a mighty extraterrestrial who will give them the guidance they are seeking. Skip down to verse 11. Manoah arose and went after his wife and came to the man and said to him, are you the man that spoke to my wife? And he said, I am. And Manoah said, now let thy words come to pass. How shall we order the child and what shall we do to him? How do we get it right? By the way, that answering from the extraterrestrial visitor, where else have you heard that answer given to a challenge? From a very powerful Jewish priest, a high priest? I adjure thee in the name of the living God that thou tell us who you are. And Jesus answered and said, what? I am. So here are these two humble peasants before the creator of the universe. And the angel of the Lord says to Manoah, of all that I said to the woman, let her beware. Once again, prenatal, postnatal care instructions for the child. Diet, temperance, godly atmosphere, and most importantly, do not cut his hair. Verse 14, she may not eat of anything that comes of the vine, neither drink wine nor strong drink, nor eat any unclean thing. All that I commanded her, let her observe. What's this haircutting thing? Why was it important that Samson never have his hair cut, that no razor ever touch his head? Why? The good Lord wanted him to be fashionable and long hair was in back then? What is so special to the Hebrew mind about the cutting of hair? Let me ask it a different way. Some of you will remember the story of Queen Esther. It's a story that is still celebrated in the Jewish faith today with a festival called Purim, where you have these little triangular cookies that or pastries that are supposed to represent Haman's ears. Some people said it was Haman's head. And they have this big festival. In fact, it's the one time in the entire year when devout practicing Jews are allowed to get totally smashed drunk, because it's a celebration of the deliverance of Israel. And every time Haman comes on the stage in the play that they put on, you have these little noisemakers, and you crank the things around, you hiss and boo, and it's quite a fun festival. But before you get to the happy part of hissing and booing Haman and getting drunk to celebrate the victory of Israel, what did Mordecai do when he found out about the death decree? Tore his clothes, cut his hair, and wore sackcloth and ashes. You see, to the Jewish mind, the tearing of hair, the cutting of hair, is designed to show great grief, the loss of a loved one, the extermination of the Jewish state. Why is it important that Samson not cut his hair? Because not cutting his hair is a sign that the war is over, the oppression is ended, victory is at hand, it is time to celebrate. Divine power is about to be seen as never before in history. Israel is going to be freed by a divinely empowered man. It is time to begin celebrating. Overwhelmed, Manoah wants to do something to celebrate this good news. And he's obviously not a rich man. When God visited Abraham, Abraham slayed a fatted calf. All poor Manoah can afford is one of his goats. And as he's sitting there preparing the sacrifice, he asks a question that has been gnawing at his mind. Who is this wonderful visitor? What is his name? And back comes the answer, wonderful beyond comprehension. And with that, the heavenly guest is gone up in the smoke of the fire and disappears heavenward. Manoah and his wife are on the ground with their faces to the earth, and Manoah speaks first. He says the obvious. We're dead. We have seen the face of God. But his wife, like most good Jewish mothers, applies cold logic and classic Jewish rhetoric to the question that her husband posed. So think already. If he were going to kill us, why did he talk to us? Well, a couple survives their encounter with divinity, and when Samson is born, he is given a special name. His name means like the sun, and the adventure began. It probably went really good right up until puberty hit, and somewhere in young manhood, Samson's hormones collided with cultural expectations, and it came time for him to find a wife. Well, he looked around at the available candidates, and he walked in one day, and he said, Mom, Dad, we live in Loma Linda. And Mom and Dad said, yes, there's lots of nice girls here. And he said, well, yeah, but just down the road, there's this place called San Bernardino. And I'm going to go there and look for a wife. I've heard of this village. It's called Spearmint Rhino. And they say it's a gentleman's club. Maybe I could find somebody there. Have you ever noticed that places like that engage in shameless false advertising? Rather than being a gentleman's club, I think the appropriate title would probably be Dirty Old Men's Club, but no one's ever brought that lawsuit that I'm aware of. At any rate, Samson gets into his car and trucks off for that era's version of San Berdu, and on the way, as usually happens, God throws a roadblock in his path. You ever notice that when God has a plan for you and you try to stray away from it, that God puts roadblocks in your way? See, the Lord doesn't give up easy. He keeps throwing obstacles in your path to remind you of what the divine plan is. Sometimes he allows misfortunes to push us back onto the right road. And if it doesn't work on plan A, then there's a plan B. And if not plan B, then plan C. God tries in every way he can, even through misfortune, to push us back on the right road and to salvage as much as possible, even from our own wasted lives and our own mistakes. Sometimes he uses animals. With Balaam, he used an ass. With Samson, he tried a lion. Now, I know that the Bible says Samson's trip to Philistia was God's doing. But understand that to the Hebrew mind, what God does not prevent, he is believed to have caused. And God was obviously trying to send Samson a serious wake-up call. But God had also given this young man supernatural strength, and now Samson uses it on one very surprised, soon-to-be ex-lion. You see, Samson's first mistake, or perhaps his second, was using God's gifts not for others' benefit, but for his own. You might note that during his time on this earth, that is one mistake Jesus never made. He never used his supernatural power to help anyone. That included himself. Always, 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 the Lord used his power to help others. Unfortunately for Samson, the focus of his gift now goes to himself. He kills brutally and quickly his awesome strength, his reflection in the mirror. Wow, do I look buff! And after finding a wife, not from his own people, still basking at the memory of his exploit at his wedding, he tries to do something clever and keep it alive with a riddle, which led, as games usually do, to the female playing it better than the guy who started it. So now we're ready for Judges chapter 14 and verse 16. And Samson's wife wept before him and said, "Thou dost but hate me, and you love me not. You have put forth a riddle to the children of my people, but you haven't told me." And Samson said to her, "Behold, I have not told it to my father or my mother, and why should I tell it to you?" So get the picture. We've got a whole week of, "You don't love me. You never loved me." And even Superman finally can't take it anymore. And he next does five predictable things in what I choose to call the male syndrome. What's the first? It's in the next verse. What's the first thing Samson does? Right, he gave in. So step number one in the male syndrome, he gives in. What's the next thing he does? Yes, sir? There's one thing that happens before he leaves. That's actually step number three. Step number two, he gets mad. Step number three, he leaves. What's step number four? Excuse me? Right, I'll lump that in with he gets mad. He overreacts, he gets mad, he leaves. But after he overreacts, gets mad, and leaves, what's the next thing he does? Not quite there. Step number four, he gets runner's remorse. Step number five, he comes back. And then we go through the whole cycle again, including he gets mad, he captures lots of foxes, kills lots of people, burns lots of wheat fields, and so forth. But before we get there, does this pattern of the male syndrome sound familiar to any of the men in the audience? Don't raise your hands. So Samson returns. He comes back, steps number five, only to find his new bride in the arms of his best man. She was lonely. Other than that, Samson, how did you enjoy your wedding? Once again, Samson uses his enormous, awesome personal strength to his own personal advantage and begins an increasingly vicious slaughter of the Philistines. First it was 30 victims, then revenge on the entire gang that had murdered his ex-wife, then finally 1,000 combat-hardened Philistine infantry slain with the jawbone of an ass. It's amazing how when heroes of faith step off of God's path, they find themselves frequently confronted by asses. Balaam, Samson. Occasionally, they can use them to their benefit, as did Samson, because there was no stopping this incredible hulk of a man whose biceps carried in their tissues, veins, tendons, the gift of cosmic power. For a time, Samson seems to have learned his lesson, and his life and his choices seem to have retreated to an uneasy peace. For 20 years, he judged Israel. But as members of Congress like to remind us, even middle age is no guarantee of moral rectitude. And so Samson the giant fell once more, this time to a prostitute in Gaza, and God's hero, the judge of Israel, the holder of an enormous cosmic gift, awakes in shame to the noise of a snoring Philistine whore, and this time he has to flee for his life, escaping carrying the gates of the city up the hill. Roadblocks? Was God still trying to call him back before the ultimate disaster? But still, his hormones rule him rather than reason, and finally he makes the ultimate unrecoverable mistake. Her name is Delilah, and she probably was really something to see. But that was the problem. Samson wouldn't be seeing her for very long. Because of her, he would lose everything, strength, hope, destiny, even his sight. Once warned by a beast, the champion of Israel ultimately behaved like one until the Philistines put him to work like one, and the giant ended his life in an agony of darkness. Having shut his eyes to the truth, he lost the capacity to see at all. And a young man for whom God had incredible dreams left nothing but a wretched story of what might have been. Hold that thought. We'll come back to it before we close. But first, let's talk about the other two lives. Number two is Saul. Somewhere around 1095 BC, a son was born to a man named Kish. He must have been a special child. He was named Saul, which literally translated means desired, anticipated, dreamed of. To a lesser degree than Samson, he too was a hunk. Head and shoulders taller than the other guys, captain of his high school football team, a manly man, as a former governor of this state liked to call them, and probably a ladies' man as well. Charmingly, he appears to have been a little bit shy, which probably didn't hurt his image with the young ladies at all. And Saul, the future champion of Israel, was born at a magic moment, on the crest of a wave of change. For centuries, the Philistines had ravaged Israel after Samson's terrible mistake, and Israel began to wonder, they've got a king. They seem to be doing pretty well. Is that their secret? Never bothering to realize that Israel's king had lighted the stars. God had accepted their rejection of him, and Samuel was commanded to set the change in motion, to find Israel a king, a human king to lead it. And one day, a tall young man, tired and bewildered, on the hunt for a few lost donkeys, ambled into the district of Zuph, that is its name. The young man was out of food, thirsty, and nearly broke. If you want, you can read the whole story in 1 Samuel chapter 9, but let me quickly paraphrase it for you. This young guy named Saul, desired, the anticipated one, was hoping to buy some help from Samuel for a quarter of a shekel. That's all the money he had left, but he figured that this famous seer might be able to help him find his father's lost donkeys. Instead, Samuel took him to a public feast, had the waiters bring him a special cut of meat. It was an entire leg of something. The Bible doesn't tell us what. And on the way out, Samson reached for a horn of oil and poured that on his head. Notice the symbolism here. The Holy Spirit is being poured onto this young man. The Holy Spirit obviously entered his mind because he soon began to prophesy. A beginning that's so stellar, so blessed, one wonders how anything could possibly ever go wrong. But it did. For a time, Saul was brilliant. Nahash, the Ammonite, the descendant of Lot's incestuous younger daughter, besieged Jabesh-Gilead and graciously offered them survival if every man in the town would voluntarily blind himself in his right eye. That's such a wonderful offer, it's amazing that Jabesh-Gilead did not immediately accept it. Instead, what they did was they sent out a call across all of Israel. Saul heard that call. He said, "I want every Israelite that can bear arms to meet me." He raised a 330,000-man army and then proceeded to do a classic envelopment in depth. In doing so, Saul proved himself to be an incredibly capable general, particularly in deploying three separate divisions of his army in a classic pincer movement at night. And by the time the morning came, night combat is incredibly difficult, particularly back then when they did not have night vision devices, infrared imaging, thermal imaging. Saul leads three parts of his army into a classic envelopment in depth at night, and by the time dawn comes, there is not enough left of the Ammonite army to even find each other. But Saul, faced with the greatest challenge most biblical heroes of faith encountered, couldn't seem to handle his own success. He couldn't follow the divine playbook, and swollen with his own importance, he presumed to act as a priest, which Samuel rebuked. Poor Saul again did not learn his lesson, and at his victory over the Amalekites, he couldn't resist taking spoils in direct contravention of God's instructions. And some of those spoils of victory included prisoners who would bring to the very heart of Israel a toxic form of idolatry. After that, God said the fateful words to Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 15 and verse 10, "I am grieved that I have made Saul king." Poor Samuel was so distressed at this that he cried all night, but the next day he went out. He surprised Saul at the foot of Mount Carmel, where, oddly enough, Saul was erecting a monument to himself. And Samuel delivered God's tragic pink slip, his notice of termination. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 17 and 23. "Although you were once small in your own eyes, the Lord has rejected you as king." Saul's life had begun on a crest so charmed it seemed to be headed straight for the stars. It ended in melancholia, depression, bouts of homicidal insanity, and finally, in a witch's den where his violent death was foretold. Why? Like Samson, he couldn't resist looking at the person God had blessed and forgetting where the blessing came from. Which leads us to story number 3. Saul, who became Paul. He too was born to good fortune. In the city of Tarsus, on the southern coast of today's Turkey, Tarsus basked in the warmth of the northern Mediterranean. In the Roman civil wars, it had taken the side of Caesar, and when Caesar prevailed, Augustus made it a free city. Renowned for education, it was compared by Strabo to Athens and Alexandria. And from this wealthy and intellectual center came a young devout Jewish lad named Saul. Again, the name means desired. He grew up ritually observing Shabbat, Friday evening services, Sabbath day rest, then at sunset, probably something like today's Havalo to commemorate the Sabbath's passing. Somehow he found his way to Jerusalem where he studied law and under Gamaliel, one of the most brilliant jurists of that time, in fact, of all time in Talmudic and Mishnaic law, young Saul became a clerk to the Israeli Supreme Court. Back then they called it a disciple. He was a clerk of the court. He clerked for Gamaliel, one of its brightest and best members, a jurist so brilliant that together with his arch rival Hillel became a noted sage who in all likelihood had committed the entire Torah to memory and could, when asked, out-debate the entire Sanhedrin. In fact, it was Gamaliel whose brilliant defense of the early Christian church bought them the critical time they needed to survive and to prosper. So here's young Paul, clerking for one of the court's brightest jurists. He was on track, in fact, to become a member of the Sanhedrin himself. As today, where if one wants an appointment on the federal bench, the surest way to get there is to clerk for a federal judge. Young Paul does the right thing. He gets the absolute best job you can have straight out of law school. He goes to work for one of the best jurists in the nation's history. And unlike today, where you actually have to go out and prove you can do something before you are nominated by the president for the federal bench, in ancient Israel, the great Sanhedrin had a special rule of jurisprudence that, to my knowledge, is unique among legal history. I've never found any other court that followed this rule of procedure. But the Sanhedrin was so committed to saving the life of innocent people that if in a capital case where a son or daughter of Israel was on trial for their lives, if a disciple of the court, if a clerk of the court could think of a theory that would save the life of the accused that had not occurred to the other 71 members of the court, that young person was instantly elevated to life membership as a justice of the great Sanhedrin. So here's Saul with one murder trial and one bright idea, one capital case and one bright idea between him and membership on Israel's highest court. A young disciple candidate member perfectly willing to cultivate anyone who might give him a hand up the ladder, even if that meant holding the outer cloaks of angry members of the great Sanhedrin bent on stoning a nobody named Stephen. But as Saul stood there, keeping the rich garments out of the dirt, he watched something that he would soon endure. Stephen seemed to look straight into the cosmos as if time and space no longer existed, as if a corridor had opened straight to the cosmic throne. And at that time, as Saul, who would become Paul, watched this play out, he only became angrier. An anger that may have carried more than a little political ambition. But one day Saul, the rising star of conservative, observant Israel, head of what today we would call the Department of Homeland Security, was nearing the Damascus Gate with a gaggle of temple police and possibly some off-duty for-hire legionnaires bent on destroying Christianity when, like Stephen, that same cosmic corridor opened and he saw the throne. Unlike Samson, unlike Saul, the king of Israel, when that happened to Saul, who would become Paul, it was not yet too late. You see, Saul had not yet knowingly rejected truth. He was misinformed, but he was honest. Samson and Saul, the king, had been informed and dishonest. Dishonest with themselves, dishonest with their destiny, dishonest with their Lord. When someone lives up to all the truth they know, God bears long. God forgives for long periods of time. And though Saul would probably struggle with a lifelong visual impairment, because like Samson, Saul also lost his sight when he saw the cosmic throne. Although Saul would probably live the rest of his life not seeing very well to remind him how close he came to losing everything, Saul was capable of becoming a new man named Paul. And in that name, there is a very important story to tell. Does anybody know what Paul means? It means little. Little in his own eyes, nothing. He went from being desired to being little. And after a learning experience at Athens, he realized he had nothing to say, nothing that is, except Christ and him crucified. Three stories of three lives. All began well. All three had privilege, promise, opportunity, and divine blessing. All three became at one point legends of Israel. One a king, one a judge, one a clerk to the highest court in the land, and ultimately the head of a major Israeli agency. But that's not where the story ends for any of them, and it shouldn't. My life, my job defending white-collar criminals, has taught me that the true measure of a person is not their successes, but their failures. You see, it is in failure. It is how we react to failure that we discover our true character. And so today, sitting here in one of the finest educational institutions in the world, in one of the nicest and most pleasant places to live, in what is still the greatest nation on earth, most of you can identify with the way these stories began. You are privileged. You have a future of opportunities limited only by what you can dream. You are blessed. But you will also face disappointments, like Samson, Saul, and Paul. You will try and sometimes fail. You will face physical, emotional, and spiritual challenges. Perhaps that is why so much of the Bible is devoted to stories of people who faced great challenges and frequently failed themselves in the Lord. The question is not whether you will face trials and fail them at times. The question is how you will react and overcome them. And so today, let us consider how each of those three stories ends. Saul, tall, good-looking, a one-time prophet of God and king of Israel, ended the journey he began with God's blessing and presence, utterly alone. Having abandoned his faith, he sought out the company of a witch and spent his last few hours on this earth before committing suicide, watching his sons die, and the nation he had been charged with protecting be destroyed. And what of Samson? The giant of Israel, its judge, a man capable of killing 1,000 trained combat infantry with his bare hands. That man ended up chained, weak, and working like the animal God had tried to use to warn him. You see, Samson's greatest weakness had been his eyes. So God took those away from him. And for day after day, week after week, year after year, Israel's former champion walked in a circle, taunted and belittled by those who used to fear him. One wonders what went through his mind all those years. Perhaps memories of his childhood and of godly parents, of a mother singing the Sabbath Hallel and of a father reading from the Torah. Memories of Sabbath services and his bar mitzvah, where he was called to the law. Perhaps he also remembered and regretted his mistakes. But as time went on, tragic Samson, so strong in many ways and weak in others, trapped in his prison of darkness, finally saw what he'd always missed when he had the gift of vision, that his only strength was the God he had abandoned. And so he began to pray. First, he probably prayed for forgiveness. Then for just enough strength to do the menial work demanded of him by the Philistines. And finally, a man whose name meant like the sun, no longer so blinded by God's blessings that he could not see from where they came, became small. His story could have ended there. But unlike Saul, whose story ends in solitary tragedy, Samson reminds us that even the worst failures can be redeemed by God. Having finally learned to pray, to see God through a world of blackness, Samson triumphed. You see, the Philistines made the mistake of believing they were dealing with a man whose strength could be chained. And so the final chapter of Samson's life was written with him standing in a pagan temple to be ridiculed as a man who had failed. Israel's judge, captured in the arms of a prostitute. But standing there in chains, all Samson could see was his faith. And he began to pray, Shema Yisrael, Yadonai Eloheinu, Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Dear God, just one more time. If it be your will, could I have my strength? Not for me, but for your people, for you. History tells us that with one final divine blessing, with one act of incredible superhuman strength, tragic Samson escaped his prison of darkness and of pride and did more with God's presence in one act than he had his entire life by himself. And finally, the hour grows late. I must speak of Paul. Probably the least attractive of the three, also probably the smartest. Like Samson, he would lose his sight. Like Saul, he was anointed by God as a leader of his church. Like both, he would suffer a violent death, probably beheading, if the history is to be believed. But unlike Saul, who went to his death in a hopeless fog of spiritual dementia and a witch's curse, or Samson, who went to his in a mercy-inspired act of strength, Paul looked through the grave to see a crown and to know, without a question of a doubt, that he would one day see the King. Three stories of three lives. I suggest to you today that each of you is writing the story of your life every day, one choice at a time. When it is done, it will tell of triumphs and, yes, of failures, of challenges faced and choices made. But how will it end? That today and for every day to come is up to you. Thank you all. God bless you.